Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today I have a special show because I have on the phone right now legendary artist Harvey Scales. So Harvey, can you hear me right now?
Yeah, Bob, you're coming in clear.
Okay, great. So today, at least for the first part of the show, we will be talking to Harvey about his career and his history and going through all the stuff he did in the 60s and 70s through today. So, first of all, thanks so much for being on the phone with me.
Oh, yes, this is a great talking to you, Bob. We had a great time in Chicago both times we were together.
Yeah, well, hopefully the interview will go great, too.
So, we're not on the air?
No, we're on the air right now. Can you start off by talking about where you're originally from?
I was originally born in Osceola, Arkansas, home of Albert King. This interview might sound like I'm name dropping, but all this is true, and I knew all these people.
Okay.
But, moved to Memphis, which is right close to here, and my mom moved to South Bend, Indiana from there, then to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Detroit for a while, you know, and got kind of hooked up writing and stuff and doing stuff in Motown.
So
then I ended up back in Milwaukee, and now I live in Atlanta. And my mom lives in Milwaukee, and she's ill, and I'm here taking care of her now.
Where were you when you first got involved with music?
Professionally, Milwaukee as a teen.
How old were you about?
I'd say around 15.
And what did you first do? Did you start singing? Did you play an instrument? How did you get started?
We started with doo-wop groups, you know. We tried to mimic groups like the Dells and the Ellerals and the Platters and all them, and we were called street corner harmony groups at that time. You know, we sung in the streetlights on the corner, you know.
So you were in high school at the time?
Yeah, a school called North Division in Milwaukee. And my friend, who was Al Jarreau, who lived in the same neighborhood, he went to a school called Lincoln. But we did form a street corner group at the time, you know.
So you sang in a local group with Al Jarreau, you're saying?
Yeah, when we were just kids, you know, started out teenagers, you know. And then I had a group called the Playboys, and he had a group called the Sophisticates, and we kind of, like, intermingled quite a bit, you know. During that time, all the groups were intermingled. And them days, instead of gangs, you had groups, you know.
What years were that when you were singing in a group?
Oh, that was like, you know, 59, 60, you know.
And I have a record that Al Jarreau released out of Milwaukee on Raynard Records called I'm Not Afraid. You don't know if you're singing on that, do you?
I don't know. We used to sing, like I said, we used to intertwine in so much stuff, you know. I used to sing on a lot of stuff I would do in the studio and that he would do in different groups, you know. I like to hear it, you know.
I'll send you audio of it. So when you were in high school, were there other groups in your school that ever recorded?
Well, the biggest group that I got when I was a kid, in my late teens and early 20s, was called the Esquires. And they recorded a song in Chicago, which, like Chicago, was always my second home, you know, musically, you know. And the name of the song was Get On Up, you know, Get On Up, Get On Up, Get On Up, you know.
So that,
I don't know if you ever heard that song. You probably have.
Yeah, it was a huge hit. I think it's from 1967 when that record came out.
Yeah, right, right.
But
when that finally came. But by then, I was with the Seven of Sound.
Yeah, your first few records came out before that, actually.
Yeah. Actually, we made Get Down, which prompted them to sing Get On Up, you know. And I used to be in a group with them, and then I went with the Seven Sounds, and we made Get Down. The first song I recorded with the Seven Sounds was called Glamour Girl.
Yeah, which is a great song.
Yeah, that was like the first song I did with them. The first song I ever recorded that was a professional recording was called The Clock.
Yeah, which I have here to play, actually. What's the story behind this record?
The Clock, that's a real story because I used to be at home sleep, you know, and my mother wanted me to go get a job. So she put the phone in my room with the alarm on it, you know, so it would wake me up. You know, and she used to do it so much that I wrote a song called "The Tick Tock of the Clock," you know. And as soon as I got a chance, and I actually, you know, was singing with a group also at the time, sometimes called Bird Legs. I don't know if you heard of them.
There were Bird Legs and Pauline.
Yeah, Pauline, right. And it was on Cuckoo Records at the time. And I actually, my friend was Junior Brantley, the keyboard player, who ended up playing with Room Full of Blues and a lot of other bands, you know. But I ended up just going along with him to the session with Bird Legs now. And I actually showed them the clock in the car. We got up there after they finished their session, then I did the clock, you know.
Okay, and they're actually playing on the record, right? It says on the record.
Burleigh's is playing on the record. Yeah, I mean, his band, you know.
And are they singing backup, too?
There was no backup on that particular. It was just me singing, doing the vocals, but they played the music.
And do you remember what year this came out?
It had to be about 63, 64, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I think that's when the Burleigh's record came out, too, around 63, something like that.
Their big hit was Spring.
Yeah, and it first came out on Kooka and then came out on VJ.
Right. Well, actually, they were the first ones that made Kooka think of doing R&B songs. Before that, it was just doing polka, you know.
So how'd you get hooked up with Kooka Records in Wisconsin?
Yeah, through Bird Lake, because they had Spring, and they went back up there to record some more songs, and I just went with them. You know, and that's how I met Kirk Stein, the people at Kooka, and we showed them the song Tick Tock of the Clock, and it's a great song, you know, when we're right in and recorded that day, you know.
Okay, well, let me play the record and then we could talk a little bit more.
Okay.
This is Harvey Scales with his very first record, and it is called The Clock.
The tick, tick, tock of the clock is driving me mad. Because I need your love so bad. Won't it ever stop, stop, stop? The tick, tick, tock of the clock. Every single moment of the day is ticking my whole life away. The tick, tick, tock of the clock.
Okay, that was just Harvey Scales, just billed as Harvey on the record, with his very first record called The Clock. And if you're just tuning in, Harvey Scales is on the phone right now from Milwaukee. Harvey, are you out there?
Yeah, I'm right here, Bob.
Okay. So one thing about that record, we were just talking, it came out around 63, 64. It says Twistin' Harvey on the record. Were you Twistin' Harvey back then?
Well, as you know, Bob, I know you've heard, you weren't born then probably, but there was a big dance called The Twist by Chubby Checker.
Okay.
And everything was twist, twist this, twist everything, you know. And he came to Milwaukee and they had me on the show, and I actually out-twisted Chubby, me and my band, and and became Twistin' Harvey, you know.
So you were, like, locally known as Twistin' Harvey.
Right. You know, actually, me and the Seven Sounds actually, you know, actually really fed the area of rhythm and blues. They'd never tasted it before.
So were you one of the first R&B groups, you're saying, in Milwaukee?
Yeah, well, not so much Milwaukee, but the surrounding cities, which is like Oshkosh, Green Bay, Appleton, you know, Kenosha, you know, Racine, all that. We were like, we were the first. And some of those areas that never even heard of Groovin' Blues, except maybe Chubby Checker on the radio, Ray Charles on the radio, Sam Cooke, but they never seen any live R&B artists until we started going up there.
So you're saying you were one of the first black R&B artists to tour Wisconsin.
I would say we were the first black. Matter of fact, when we started going to Green Bay, which was like our second home at the time in Wisconsin, it was just us and the Packers, the few Packers that was there, Willie Davis, Willie Wood, Elijah Pitts, you know, Lyle Aldridge, you know, on the Packers, you know.
Okay.
And the Southern Sound, we were actually only African Americans in town at the time.
So that first record, The Clock, how old were you when it came out?
21, I think, or 20.
And did it get any play in Milwaukee?
Yeah, quite a bit. Because they had, in Milwaukee, they had some iconic DJs, which was, the guy's name was Dr. Bop and O.C. White, and they were like legends of the radio, you know.
So they pushed your record.
Yeah, and you know, even on the pop station, they had a big R&B station, which is called Wawa, WAWA, and WOKY, you know. Then eventually we got on in Chicago on WBON, you know.
But The Clock, it didn't really get play in Chicago, did it? It was more like a local record?
Not as much as a lot of other records that were recorded in Chicago.
And so the next record you recorded was Glamour Girl.
Right. We got a call from Kuka that liked The Clock so much, you know, that can you guys come back, got any more material? And I said, yeah, we just wrote a song, Glamour Girl. Next week we went up there and recorded it. Me and the bass player wrote it on the back porch one day, you know.
It's a great, great song that you wrote
quickly. Yeah, and it was actually, in those days, for some reason, the B-sides were the better sides a lot of times, you know. Because the A-side was actually a song called The Streets of New York City.
Yeah. So you were already hooked up with the Seven Sounds for this record, right?
Oh, yeah. We had been together about 2 years before we released that.
So you said before you were with the Seven Sounds, you were with the Esquires, is that right?
Right.
So the Esquires were together long before they recorded Get On Up.
Yeah, it was a high school group.
And what high school did they go to?
North Division.
And that's what, so you were in high school with the Esquires.
Right. I mean, we were neighborhood buddies, you know.
So what's the story? Why did you leave the Esquires and join the Seven Sounds?
What happened, ironically, there's two brothers in the Esquires, the Moore brothers, and they had a little complication.
Okay.
The police one night after a dance, you know. And they ended up going to reform school for a couple of years. And during that time, I got with the Seven Sounds, you know.
So were the Seven Sounds already together, or did you form the group?
No, not really formed them. They were, you know, they were playing. They had a lead singer named Lee Brown, and him and I joined the group, and him and I used to do, like, the Sam and Dave thing, you know.
Okay. So,
two lead vocalists, you know.
And they were they a vocal group or a band?
There was a band. It started out as a jazz group called the Conservatives.
Okay.
And then they later on changed it to the Seven Sounds.
And were they about the same age as you?
Yeah.
So you ended up cutting this song, Glamour Girl, which you said you wrote with the bass player of the group.
Right, Al Vance.
And the song, you guys have pretty nice harmony on the record.
Yeah, well, the Seven Sounds, actually, before people picked up instruments in them days, everybody doo-wop. Like I said, everybody mimicked the Dells and, you know, and the El Dorados and the Platters and all these groups. So when you had a band back in them days, you didn't need a backup that much because most bands sing and play.
So do you remember, so were there seven guys in the Seven Sounds?
Yeah, there was myself. There was actually, most of the time, sometimes there was myself and six guys. But a lot of times it was myself and seven guys when the other singer was there.
Do you remember, do you remember the seven people besides you that are on the Glamour Girl record?
Yeah.
What are their names?
Ben Petrie. He played the baritone sax, but he was also a fantastic singer. And Rollo Armstead, he played the tenor sax, and he was also a good singer. And Monty Smith was a trumpet player who switched on keyboards, and he was also a good singer. All these guys were mostly kind of front men, along with me most of the time. Because what would happen is, they would put their horns down and turn into the Temptations, you know. That was one of our big, you know, our big things as far as the draw. Our live show, you know. Our live show was fantastic. You know, we used to battle Baby Hugh and the Babysitters and all these groups in Chicago. And one of our main things was we could, you know, we were real convertible. You know, we could turn into the Temptations or Cannonball Alley. Quintet at the drop of a hat, you know.
Do you remember any of the, I think you gave three of the members, do you remember any of the other four?
Yeah, Al Vance was my writing partner, he was the bass player, the guitar player was Rudy Jacobs, the drummer was Billy Stonewall, you know, and that was the group, and Lee Brown, the other singer sometimes.
Okay. Okay, well, I'm going to play Glamour Girl because it's a great record, and then we can talk a little bit more.
Sure.
So, and this came out, do you remember what year this came out?
I believe it was about 64, 65, you know, because sometimes you recorded a record, and sometimes it was a year before it came out, you know.
Okay, well, this is Harvey Scales with the Seven Sounds this time.
Right.
And this is Glamour Girl.
It probably says Harvey and the Seven Sounds.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
Okay, so this is Glamour Girl.
Glamour girl, glamour girl, glamour girl. Everyone knows you're the
Okay, that was just... Sorry, that was just Harvey Scales with the Seven Sounds, his first record with the group.
Yeah, that record's something else, man. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great...
That's what my voice is like, Smokey Robinson's, you know?
Yeah, you didn't... Yeah, that excellent sort of group ballad that you did called Glamour Girl. And what, so did you said it was actually the B-side or the intended B-side of the record?
Yeah, yeah. The A-side was actually on the streets of New York City.
Did either side get any play on the radio?
Oh, yeah. Glamour Girl got a lot of play.
So the DJs flipped it over.
In Wisconsin, they, regionally, it was a big hit.
And so did you start... So, and you said you had been with the Seven Sounds for a couple of years before that.
Right.
Did you guys start doing more shows or touring more?
Oh, yeah, we played all the time. We played, see, Wisconsin is a big college state, you know, they had Madison University and they had all the UWM extensions and all that, and Marquette, you know, so we played all the, in those days. This is the Animal House days, John Belushi days. You know? Yeah, really. And we were actually the group slated, our manager slated us to play the song Shout, because that was our big college song, Shout. You know you make me want to shout. You remember that song?
Yeah.
And instead we went somewhere, New York, California, nowhere. We weren't available when they did the movie. And that's how... Otis Day and the Nights end up doing that song in the movie. That was supposed to be us.
Oh, so you were supposed to be in Animal House?
Yeah, Otis Day and the Night, that was Dwayne Jackson. And they was actors. They weren't even a real band. They turned into a real band after the movie was a hit and the song and all that, you know.
So you said, did you mainly play the college circuit at the time you were saying toured?
Yeah. We played Chicago a lot, the Aragon Ballroom and all that stuff. And Rush Street there, part of town Chicago at that time called Rush Street, you know. That was real big on R&B and stuff, and we played there a lot, you know.
So it sounds like you played for a lot of white audiences at clubs and shows?
My main audience all my career has been predominantly white.
Okay. And you said that earlier that you were kind of like one of the groups you played with a lot was Baby Huey and the Babysitters.
Yeah, all the time. That was our competition on all these college gigs. And, you know, they in those days, they had what you call beer bars. 18 years old, you could go on a bar and drink beer, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That made all the college towns had these clubs, you know.
Yeah, you're one of the, like, I've talked to some groups that did some college shows, but you're the first act I'm talking to that whose main audience was sort of college students.
Yeah, I see a lot of people now when I perform, even now, come to me and say, yeah, I remember you from college when I was 17, you know, and they're like 60 now, you know.
But you still got played on R&B radio, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you also get played on white radio too?
Somewhat. Not as much as we would like to report to Ben, you know. In them days, you know, it was like you fought to cross over, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that on the radio you get played on black stations, but your audience at colleges was a white audience.
Yeah, because the audience at the college when at that time went more for the live than they did the recording, you know.
So what was your live show like?
Oh, man, our live show was always real crazy, you know, which is why the college kids loved us. There was another band, too, that was our kind of competitors. I don't know if you heard them, called Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and their whole thing was like the, you know, the comedy gimmicky kind of thing. And we incorporated that into our show along with the real music, you know.
So, like, what's an example of, like, a comedy routine you would do on a show?
We used to do this thing. One thing was we used to call ourselves High in the Hoss and the Supremes, me and three guys out of group, but we dress up like Diana Ross and the Supremes and come out and do, Supreme songs. You know, we stop in the middle of each verse and, you know, come up with a joke like, I ain't a girl, you're so flat. And then we grab our chest, you know, and then go back into the song, you know, that type of stuff.
So you were touring pretty much all the time, is that right?
Yeah, we played all the time, you know. And then once we got into that college circuit in Milwaukee, we started playing the New York college circuit, the East Coast Dartmouth College, and you know, all those East Coast colleges and Carolina and all over. You know, we were busy all the time.
And so were you doing?
And we played Northwestern and then Chicago and all that.
So were you doing music full time in the 60s already?
Yeah.
And one thing I got to ask is, I know Ike and Tina Turner did the college circuit. Did you ever run into them?
I remember meeting Ike and Tina about 64, 65, something like that. There's a place in Milwaukee called the Southside Armory where them, Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, and Bobby Bland would frequently come there. And that's where we got a lot of ideas for live shows from Tina and Bobby Bland.
So you were touring at the time, and then pretty soon you recorded, I think you recorded one more record for Kooka Records called Monkey Time 67.
Yeah, well, that's a funny thing, man, because we were one of the first bands to play with Major Lance on Monkey Time Live. We came to Chicago to do, what was the name of the ballroom? The ballroom slips on that. We came there, and Monkey Time had just came out. We heard it in the car. And we got there, and Major didn't have a band, and we played the song behind him right there, you know. So that was all like always one of our big songs on our show was Monkey Time.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so we ended up playing that. And one of my opening numbers with the band, you know, back in those days, bands had instrumentals. They recorded instrumental records.
Okay.
You know, Green Onions and all that stuff was big hits. Cool the Gang and all that. You know, they recorded a lot of instrumentals. You don't hear instrumentals today that much, you know.
No.
But back then, it was instrumentals. So that's why they did Bootleg. That was a cover of a Booker T and MG song.
So that was one of the songs that you did on your shows, you're saying?
Oh, yeah, that was like before I came out to sing, the band would always do, you know, 20 minutes, 15 minutes, half hour, whatever, you know. And, you know, they always did a lot of instrumentals, and then the other guys would sing, you know. Then they would bring me on for the Star Time situation.
So then after those three records that you recorded on Kooka Records, you ended up recording on Magic Touch Records, and you ended up recording.
Yeah, what happened there, Lenny LaCour was our producer, and we met him in Milwaukee. He used to own Magic Touch was actually a place that covered couches and whatever, plastics, you know.
You're saying it was in a
plastics, yeah.
It was an upholstery place?
Yeah, upholstery kind of place, but they only dealt in plastics, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, but anyway, that's where the Magic Touch came from. But
what did Lenny have?
But Lenny also was a singer and a musician, and he had the And he had been producing some other stuff, and he had the music in his blood, really, you know. So he was always after us to record a song for his label, you know, because we used to play in Milwaukee quite a bit in the clubs, you know. And he would come in and see us, and he would always be asking us, you guys got to record for my label. So finally, we said, okay, and what came out of it was Get Down, you know. And Get Down was a national hit. What happened was he had a few connections with Stax and Atlantic. And Atlantic was distributing Stax, and Stax distributed Get Down. So Atlantic and Stax kind of distributed Get Down together, you know. And it was a national hit. It was like about 33 on the charts or something like that on Billboard.
So you were saying, did Lenny LaCour own that furniture upholstery store you were saying?
Yeah.
And he named his label. So the store was called Magic Touch, and he named his record label after it.
He just named his label Magic Touch.
And I know he had the earliest music stuff he had done, I think, was in Chicago, and then he had like a label called 620. And I think he came back to Milwaukee, so he was in Milwaukee at the time.
I don't remember 620.
I think he recorded some groups like the Swingin' Hearts in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
But you're saying he was based in Milwaukee at the time he recorded you.
Yeah. We recorded in Milwaukee at a studio called Dave Kennedy's. We did Get Down and Loveitis the same day.
So was the Get Down was a dance, right?
Right, and for some reason, again, Get Down was like a dance, and it was a big dance in Chicago and all around, you know. But for some reason, the white audience especially always liked Loveitis, and three or four rock bands, including Jay Giles' band, had the very biggest covered Loveitis, you know. There was a group out of Canada called Mandela that covered it, another group called The Road, and two of the other groups, you know. So it seems that Loveitis is always more the kind of more rock-oriented audience.
So Get Down was the original A-side, and then people started playing and covering the B-side.
Right.
Was the Get Down, it was a dance. Did you invent the dance, or were people doing the Get Down already?
No, I kind of invented it.
Did people start doing it after you came out with the record?
Yeah, everybody used to do it. Of course, it went, you know, Get Down, to the front, to the left, to the right, sock it to me now, dun, 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 dun. You know, one of those things, you know.
So
kind of tell you what to do. Then it would say, now freeze, you know, and the crowd would freeze, you know, for about 60 seconds or whatever, you know.
So the part where you say get down to the left is just kind of move to the left? Like, what does it mean?
Right. Well, you know, it means swing your hips to the left, swing your hips to the right, you know, swing your, you know, sock it to me, boom, 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 move your body back and forth, you know.
Okay. So you had that, so it became your biggest hit that you ever did was Get Down with Loveitis on the flip.
I think Broadway Freeze was probably the most exposed.
Okay, and actually, I think Broadway Freeze might have come out even before that. I might be getting the...
No, Broadway Freeze came out. Matter of fact, by this time, we were kind of like almost on Stax Records anyway, you know. So we went down south to Memphis to record that.
Okay.
And Broadway Freeze, you know. Broadway Freeze came out 2 years after Get Down.
Okay, so you were... Should I play one of the records?
Sure, whichever one you want to play.
Which song do you like better, Get Down or Loveitis?
Well, you know, my favorite is more Loveitis, but Get Down is a more commercial, you know.
Well, I'll play Get Down so people remember it.
Okay.
This is Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds with Get Down.
Get down!
Okay, that was just Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds.
Yeah, Bob, that was fun. What they call fun music back in them days. We used to have what they call fun music. You know, me and Alvin Cash and Dyke and the Blazers, a lot of groups like that. We had fun music.
So it was like a party song, you're saying?
Yeah, you know, it was always fun music. It was never nothing real negative or derogatory. It was always fun music.
And you just mentioned Alvin Cash. One thing that's interesting is the style of the record with you kind of yelling over the music was, it sounds a lot like Twine Time.
Right, right. Well, it was kind of a takeoff from that because Alvin and Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds were like kind of like all in one. Alvin, we used to back Alvin.
Okay.
You know, and in fact, before it was Alvin Cash and the Crawlers, it was Alvin Cash and the Registers.
Okay, but you weren't the Registers, right?
No, yeah, Eddie's couple of guys that danced with him. They changed the name later, you know.
Okay, so
that was a great stage act too.
So, and you did shows with him in Chicago a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Alvin Cash, Major Lance, Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, you know, we were all like kind of, you know, real close together, intertwined, the Impressions, you know.
And
the Shylights, you know, we were like the first band that Shylights had.
You're saying you played behind the Shylights?
Yeah, we were the first one. The Shylights came to Milwaukee with us, and we backed the Shylights quite a bit.
What years was that?
This is way before Have You Seen Her. This is like in '60s.
Okay. So, did you?
Matter of fact, the Shylights was called the Highlighters.
I think they were the Highlights.
The Highlighters, yeah.
And then I think they were the Chanteurs before that.
Maybe so. But I remember that. And they were the Highlights, you know. And Gene Chandler and them had the Duques, you know.
Yeah, like early '60s.
Mm-hmm. Night Owl.
Yeah, which is.
You ever heard that record?
Yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah, I like that record.
So you ended up recording a bunch of records for a lot of different labels after that.
Oh man, so many I forgot.
So one label that you got to, I think immediately after Magic Touch was Chess Records.
Yeah, man, that was Chess is some of probably our greatest sessions, you know, because we would come down to Chess and actually be in the studio and sleep on the floor, and Chuck Berry would be sleeping on the floor and everything. It's a lot of memories, you know. And they wake us up, we start recording, you know. And we just record, because that's why there were so many different songs that came out on Chess at different times, you know. Because the session today, you go and record a song, you might record one song for 6-7 hours, you know. Back then, you did 6 or 7 songs in 6 hours, you know.
Yeah, so I think initially they released 4 sides on you. One of them was the Yoke and the Funky Yoke.
Yeah. Yeah, we got into this dance thing, you know, after we did Get Down and Broadway Freeze and all that. We got into this thing of being really, Archibald and the Drells, you know. After they did Tighten Up, you know, everything was dance-orientated. So for a while, most of our songs, you know, Funky Football, The Yoke, and Get Down, Broadway Freeze, all this stuff was dance-orientated, yeah.
Yeah, you know, there was another Milwaukee artist. He was in Milwaukee at the time that recorded a Yoke record that I interviewed a few weeks ago. His name is Johnny McKinney. He recorded as Johnny Lemack. You didn't know him, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, but it must have been after your record he was inspired to also record a Yoke record on Chess Records.
No, I'd be good. I'd like to hear it.
I'll send it to you. So, and then you recorded another dance record on Chess called The Funky Football.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, all these songs, a lot of these songs, Get Down, 1970, we redid it in 70. We would do like, you know, loads and loads of material in 1 or 2 days, and sporadically they would release them later, you know.
Yeah, and then later you were just referring to, you had some more records released on the Chess subsidiary Cadet, and that was like the mid-70s that happened.
Yeah, 74 I did a song produced by Don Davis, who produced...
he was one of the Disco Lady writers.
Yeah, he produced... and co-wrote Disco Lady with me. And also before that, we did a song on Stax. You know, we were Stax quite a while too. And we did a song called I Wanna Do It. And the flip, again, was like the A-side, called What's Good For You Don't Have To Be Good To You. And I Wanna Do It was like the stronger commercial side, you know. Yeah, and but during that session I did also, I went back up and recorded I Run To Your Side with the actual studio band, with a couple of Seven Sounds playing with me, you know.
Okay, so the songs that they released later, like I'll Run To Your Side, they were recorded in like 74, 75?
Right, 74.
But you're saying
73
that...
73 and released in 74. That's Michael Henderson playing bass on there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you're saying that you recorded a lot of stuff at Chess in 1970 that was never released, though?
Yeah, quite a bit of stuff.
And you never mentioned, how did you get hooked up with Chess Records and Stax Records?
Well, I through Lenny LaCour. Like I said, you know, Lenny used to be kind of like a Chuck Berry artist, and he used to be on Chess Records.
Okay.
Him and Lenny Chess was best friends, and he went and told Lenny Chess, hey, I got this hot band from Milwaukee, blah, 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 blah. And when Leonard heard us with all the horns and stuff, he was blown away. Because we was before Earth, Wind & Fire, or anybody. There was another group from Chicago with Minnie Riffler called
Rotary Connection
at the time. You know, and I believe that Maurice from the Earth, Wind & Fire was doing stuff with them at the time.
So you're saying that you were similar to the Rotary Connection in that you were...
We were like one in the Midwest, one of the big first horn bands. So.
Okay.
And I was saying the Earth, Wind & Fire later became a big horn band, and I'm referring to Maurice White and stuff. He was working with Minnie Riperton, who was with Chess at the time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and then later there became a lot of sort of white rock horn bands too, and like
Chicago,
the group Chicago,
and Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and all that, you know.
So were you touring all the time while you were recording these two?
Yeah,
just going back and forth.
Right, and we did a lot of work in Detroit. We used to be the house band at Phelps Lounge, and we went there to play a gig, and the owner Eddie Phelps said, "Man, we'd like to keep you guys because we." What happened was Solomon Burke came to play the club. That was Phelps Lounge was like the Burning Spear or High Chaparral is where all the big R&B acts played. And every week you have somebody. So Solomon Burke came while we was there, but his band didn't show up. So we end up. He said, "Well, can you back Solomon Burke?" We said, "Yeah, I said, sure." Well, he got the record with him and went down the basement and come back, and we played that night. And so Eddie Phelps, who was the club owner, asked us to be the house band. So we backed everybody, man. You know, Johnny, that's when I first really met Johnny Taylor real good. And
the
Falcons and the Dales and everybody came through Phelps. I don't know if you saw the movie Ray Charles Ray with Jamie Foxx. I don't know if you remember the sequence where the background singer Margie Hendrix got mad and left the group.
Okay.
Yeah, and in real life, when she left, she came to Phelps Lounge, and we backed her. And she, you know, she's one of the voice on the, you know, the night time's the right time.
Yeah.
I remember I had to do the Ray Charles, you know, the night time, you know, and she did the baby, you know, that part there, you know. And she really didn't have a record, but she drew a big crowd because she was with Ray Charles.
So yeah. One thing that you mentioned before that I wanted to ask you about was Loveitis, because that song, you were saying it was covered by a lot of rock groups. So,
yeah, quite a few. Probably the most popular was Jay Giles, the Jay Giles Band, Peter Wolf and Jay Giles Band.
So did you write the song?
Yeah, myself and the guitar player wrote that, yeah.
So I hope you got royalties from all the artists that covered it.
Well, somewhat. You know how that goes.
So did you...
We're still looking for them, you know.
So I think you were telling me that you once had to do a show with one of the groups that covered it.
Yeah, Mandela, man. We didn't even know who they were.
Okay.
And I don't think they even knew who was going to be on there. It was in Chicago, the Aragon Ballroom. I know you're a young guy then, but you might have heard of the Aragon Ballroom.
It's still there.
It's still there?
Yeah.
Wow. And,
so you,
yeah.
It was like 69, something like that?
Huh?
It must have been around 1969, the show?
Yeah, something like that, right.
Because you were telling me that Baby Huey was on the show?
Yeah. Yeah, we played with Baby Huey and the Babysitters all the time.
Okay.
Matter of fact, we were like brother groups, you know. We would intertwine and have six, seven horns on stage at the same time. And me and his real name was Jimmy, you know. And we'd go out and sing Sam and Dave, and we'd have six horns band, or seven horns, you know.
So
both bands combined.
So how long did you consistently tour and perform in these clubs? Like, I know you did it throughout the 60s. How late?
Throughout the 60s and throughout the 70s. In 74, I moved to California. Right after when I first did Disco Lady, it wasn't out yet. It really didn't come out to later 75, early 76. And I was blessed because that's when they started the platinum, you know, awarding platinum. And that was the first platinum single, Disco Lady, in 1976.
Yeah, I want to get to that, but one more question I had, too, was you recorded for one more record label, which is Mercury Records.
Oh, yeah. That was another, it was in Chicago at the same time then, too.
And I think that came out around 73, something like that.
Right. See, we had a manager named Ken Adamatti. Ken Adamatti used to play... originally with the Steve Miller Band.
Okay.
And he managed Cheap Trick.
Okay.
And he was hooked up with Mercury Records at the time. And he was managed us too at the time, you know. So we ended up recording the Come Out and Shake Your Power.
And so at the time you were recording for a lot of different labels, even going back and recording for Magic Touch Records.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I wanted to ask about is, you were talking about how you ended up being the writer for the first platinum single, which is Johnny Taylor's Disco Lady. You cut a record called Groove On, Sexy Lady, which had a similar sound. Did that come out before or after?
Right, which was kind of like prompted me doing Disco Lady. We did that actually on Magic Touch in Chicago. Groove On, Sexy Lady. This is supposed to be our big comeback to mend all disagreements with Magic Touch, you know.
So
this was supposed to be our big hit again, you know. But everybody liked the record, but it was never really promoted, you know.
So you actually recorded this before Disco Lady, and
yeah,
it became one of the inspirations for the song.
Right.
Let me play the record, and we could talk more.
Okay.
This is, and it was actually, they released it twice. They released it, one like a short version, and then one a little bit longer version.
Right.
So I'm going to play the first version they released. So this is Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds with Groove On, Sexy Lady.
Down in Chicago, you can find almost anything. I met this young lady down there. Oh, she can really shake her thing. When I saw her, all I could say was, keep on doing what you're doing. That's what I told her. I said, move on, sexy lady. Move on, sexy lady. Move on, pretty baby. Like a wave on the Atlantic. Yeah. know you're trying to tease me, I'm about to pay.
Okay, that was just Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds with the original version of Groove On, Sexy Lady. And if you're just tuning in, I have Harvey Scales on the phone from Milwaukee. And we were just talking about how that song became like the prototype for Johnny Taylor's Disco Lady, which Harvey was one of the writers for. So, Harvey, can you talk about, I guess, the next big thing you did after that was to write the Johnny Taylor record. How did you get hooked up with writing that song?
Well, like I told you earlier, Don Davis from Detroit at United Sounds was our producer. United Sounds was a hot studio at the time because Don Davis did the Who's Making Love production for Johnny Taylor, which was a big hit. Also, he did the Dramatics, I Want to Go Outside in the Rain, What You See Is What You Get. Marilyn McCoo, Billy Davis, You Don't Have to Be a Star to Be in My Show, and several other hits, you know, for Johnny Taylor. And so we were all, and the Funkadelics, George Clinton, you know, which a lot of people don't realize, but that's Bootsy on bass on Disco Lady.
Oh, really? That's it? It,
yeah,
sound, it
and,
sounds like another
real on the keyboard from the Funkadelics. And also the Funkadelics, the guitar player, Glenn Goins and Bruce Nazarian, you know.
So you recorded that in Detroit?
Yeah, we recorded that at United Sound Studio.
Okay. And Don Davis was your producer at the time, so that's how you knew him. So how did you actually, what was the story of you writing Disco Lady? Did you just take that song and just kind of change it up, or?
Well, yeah, no, well, you know, we did the Groove On Sexy Lady thing like a year or so before, so Disco Lady was supposed to be like the kind of reprise of that, you know, the updated version of it, you know. And, you know, we dipped in Dale did funk a lot. And as you notice, Disco Lady is not really a disco song. It's more of a funk song.
That's right.
You know, the music, you know. And, of course, Don Davis being a producer, he said, we're going to call this Disco Lady. Because everything was disco. You know, disco potato chips and everything else, you know. Everything was disco. And so, you know, that's how it became Disco Lady. Johnny Taylor didn't even want to record the song. When Don Davis said, I got a song for you, Johnny, listen to this. Johnny was like, oh, no, man, I know, shake it up, shake it now, move it in, move it out. Now you got to come better than that. And the music, I don't know, you know. And so I said, man, it's going to work. I said the Funkadelics is in the studio, and I told Don Davis, let's get a Bootsy and the Funkadelics rhythm section to do it, and then give it to Johnny Taylor again. So that's what we did, you know.
So you're saying
that he loved it.
The Funkadelics also play, they not only play on your version, they play on Disco Lady, you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I mean, the version of Disco Lady. Now my version, I grew on Sexy Lady with the Seven Sounds.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, it was Seven Sounds, but we had, let me back up a little bit. When we went to Don Davis to do the demo, we actually cut the demo with the Isaac Brothers Band, who was in the studio recording then. It's kind of confusing. They did a demo. And
you're talking the Disco Lady demo.
Yeah, Disco Lady demo. Yeah, and then when Don Davis played it for Johnny, he was like, you know, not too carried away with it, you know.
And then you recut it.
So we cut it with Bootsy on bass, and I think that made a difference.
And that record, the Disco Lady, on writing credits, I think, is you and Don Davis. I think there's a couple.
Yeah, Al Vance.
Okay, who's that?
My bass player from the Seventh Sounds.
Okay.
He's deceased now, you know.
So Don Davis and then you two guys originally wrote the first version of the song.
No, I actually originally wrote it, and Don Davis added the bridge and stuff like that. You know?
I meant you and Vance wrote the first
yeah,
version.
Well, basically, you know, not patting myself on the back, but I actually wrote it, and I had Vance play the bass and do some other things, you know, which he contributed. And Don Davis put the bridge in it, changed the title and all that, you know.
So you must have been excited when Disco Lady was such a huge hit.
Yeah, nobody knew it was going to be that big. If I knew it was going to be that big a hit, I would have sang it myself. Johnny Taylor wouldn't have had to sing it, you know.
So, what happened? Did you start writing for more people? Or, like how come you didn't become a, like, sort of in-demand writer after writing that record?
Well, after that, you know, John, I have to give John a lot of credit because he had an eye for, like Barry Gordy, of getting people that they thought were terrific writers. And he really liked my writing ability. And, you know, he at the time, he had a lot of different artists he was producing, including the Soul Children, a lot of people, the Stax, and, you know, Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis and the Dales and the Dramatics and, you know, and I started writing for all them. Then after Disco Lady, I got with CBS directly, so I started writing for everybody, just about Tabari's, a cartoon group that at the time it was called Captain Cool on the Cone, and the Cones that came on ABC TV every Saturday.
Okay.
You know, you remember them?
No.
Yeah, you should have been about a little 12 or 13. And, you know.
I think maybe one or two I was.
Yeah. Oh, you were?
Not that old.
In 78, 79?
I was born in 78.
Oh, yeah, you were just born then. Well, anyway, they had there was Bigfoot they used to have on TV and Wild Boy, which was a Saturday kiddie show. And the hosts were Captain Cool and the Cones, but it was a recording group with CBS. And the leader was Michael Limbeck, who was Harvey Limbeck, the actor's son.
And you wrote songs that were played on the show?
Yeah, Captain Cool and the Cone. I wrote their album for them, and I also did Tavares. They had a Heaven Must Be Visiting an Angel. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I know that song.
Yeah, and
And
what are some of the? You said you wrote some Dells and Dramatics records.
Yeah, I wrote a song. Well, I have a new song when the Dells just came out. It's on CD, baby. Now, the CD is called Now and Then, the song that I wrote is called Free to Be Free.
Did you write any records for the Dells or the Dramatics in the 70s?
Yeah, I wrote a song for the Dells called Be For Real With Me.
Okay, yeah.
And a song for the Dramatics called Blaming on New York City, and another song called Come Inside.
Okay.
For the Dramatics.
And what Soul Children, and you said you wrote for the Fifth Dimension, or just Marilyn McCoo? And
just Marilyn McCoo. It's easier being friends.
And what's the Soul Children songs you wrote?
Midnight Sunshine and Goodbye Is Not the Only Way.
Okay. And another thing that was happening at the time was you signed to Casablanca Records.
Yeah, that, well, after the Disco Lady Platinum and all that, the doors are kind of open, so the manager I had at the time was real good friends with Neil Bogart. Neil Bogart was the man at the time. That was the disco era, you know. And he had Donna Summers, who was queen of the disco, and the village people, who were also queens of the disco. I mean, kings of the disco, you know. You know, it was like when I got with them, I had this album called Confidential Affair, and it was kind of R&B oriented, more Memphis Stack sounding. And they was like a deep disco label, even though I had a couple of good up-tempo records on there, but it really wasn't a disco album. It was R&B, so, you know, I don't think Casablanca was geared up and really knew how I really wanted to really push a real soul R&B album at that time. So they told me my next one, after Confidential Affair, would have to be a disco album.
Okay.
So I said, well, I don't know about doing a disco album, but so I went and wrote a disco opera. I said, I'll do it like this, and it was called Hot Foot, a disco opera, and had some of the best songs on that I feel personally that I've written in my life.
Did your disco opera have like a story?
Yeah, that's what it was.
What was the story?
It was like high school dances. Now it was the exact same thing.
So what was the story? Like, what was the story?
The story was this guy Hotfoot, that was a super dancer. Nobody knew where. If you ever saw the album cover, I got on the Superman costume.
Yes, I seen that
costume with fire in my hands and standing on a disco ball with fire in my feet. And Hotfoot was supposed to be this guy that come and dance and tore up all the turned out all the discos, and they even had a villain in it. Who went around burning up all the disco records, you know. and it was a trip, man, because for the first time I had the girls, the do-it girls, I called them. They were the ones telling the story on the album, you know, for each song, each sequence, you know. But they weren't singing it, they were rapping it. Like, we are the do-it girls. We're going to tell you a story about the disco world, that type of thing. And that was rap before rap even came up.
And
I had these visions, but everybody, I guess at the time, thought I was nuts because I was telling them we should video it. And they said, video ain't going to be here for another 50 years, you know. But it came a couple of years later.
So one thing that's interesting about the two Casablanca records is there's a famous drum sample that a lot of rappers use later.
Oh yeah, man, Soul to Soul on that song, Back to Life, Back to Reality. On that song there, the drum beat is a sample from my song Dance Room Only, off of the Hot Foot album. When I went to Europe in November, this past November to London. I went to the discos, I walked in, and they're playing Dance Room Only like crazy.
So did you, when that Soul to Soul record came out, were you surprised? Like, did you recognize that it was your drum?
I didn't even recognize the drum beat. I had to find out from England. They had a book called The Atomic, and they would write about all the samples and stuff.
And I looked in there, and it said Soul to Soul, Harvey Scales, Dance Room Only, you know.
So they were playing?
Yeah, but they really, really featured it again on... Remember the song they did, Soul to Soul, Keep On Moving?
Yeah.
Keep on moving, I don't stop, you know. Yeah, they really featured it on that, so they used it a couple times.
So you were hearing it on the radio all the time, and you just never knew it was you until later.
I knew it sounded familiar, you know. You know.
So did you do anything, what did you do in the 80s after the, because that was, those were the last albums you recorded, right?
Yeah, I was writing a lot of blues songs for ZZ Hill, and some stuff for Tyrone to do, Tyrone Davis, and Johnny Taylor, and never really got them to him and Bobby Womack, but the distributor I was doing, what he liked the way I was doing them, so he said, come, let's release it, and it's on the internet now, selling, it's called Somebody Else or Somebody.
So
it's a CD, it's a blues CD.
Are those songs you wrote in the 80s, you're saying?
No, the 90s.
Okay. And have you done anything else since, like in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, you know me, I write all the time. But as far as releases, I had I Want to Spend the Night Forever, which was released. I have to get that to you because I don't know if you got it because it was mostly released in Europe.
Okay.
All in the Night's Work, Spend the Night Forever, All in the Night's Work, We Got to Stop Meeting Like This. You know, yeah, I'm going to have to get those to you so you can check them out.
Okay, well, let me play one more of your records, and then we can talk a little bit more.
Okay.
This is a record that you did about in the mid-70s, and there's a real nice kind of Curtis Mayfield-inspired track called Trying to Survive.
Which I'm still trying to do.
So let me play the record and we can talk a little bit more. This is Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds with Trying to Survive.
Great record.
Why won't they let me be? Trying to catch them with
Okay, that was just Harvey Scales and the Seven Sounds with Trying to Survive, and that came out in the mid-70s. So I was wondering, Harvey, if you could talk about some of the things that you are doing today.
Oh, yeah, you know, ironically, Bob, I'm blessed I'm still into it, you know, even though I'm only 35. you know, which is kind of phenomenal. But, well, as you know, I just did the Hideout in Chicago a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. And
the
was
audience seems to be getting younger and younger. Either I'm getting older, you know. but I had a great time. I loved it. And, yeah, I'm still performing. A week ago, I just did a festival here in Milwaukee. And now on the first or second week in August, I'll be going into the famous Willie Mitchell studio with the High Rhythm Session doing an album.
Is it in Memphis?
Yeah, in Memphis. Either the first week in August or the second week. Believe it or not, Steven Seagal is in there now. But really, doing a blues album.
That's funny. I didn't know he was a singer.
Yeah, I don't know if he knew it either. Who's going to tell him he can't sing?
and you're becoming a movie star too now. Like he's becoming a singer, and you're becoming a movie star.
Yeah, I am. I have a cameo, and the film is called Soul Men, and it stars Bernie Mac and Samuel L. Jackson. And there's something like Sam and Dave, even though they don't call themselves that in the movie. There's something like Sam and Dave. And me and Isaac Hayes, we got cameos in the movie. And so does Millie Jackson and the new singer, John Legend.
So I'll definitely be looking out for you in the movie. Do you perform in the movie?
No, I'm not performing. I just have the cameos. I'm Isaac Hayes' buddy. And we go to the club to hear Bernie Mac damn crucified song. You know, the one, if the music makes you move, you feel like you want to groove.
Do your thing.
On. You remember that song?
Yes, Isaac Hayes, Do Your Thing.
Yeah. But Bernie Mac and Samuel L. Jackson is singing it or lip singing it, I'm not sure. In the movie, and we're in the nightclub, surrounded by all these pretty women, pretty girls, you know, and we're sitting there and checking the show out. And then it's another scene. Well, Millie Jackson is really cussing out Bernie Mac in the dressing room. And I'm in there trying to hold them together, you know.
So I'll definitely go watch it just for you.
Oh, yeah, it should be entertaining. Because, you know, the music is from that era. There's a song I wrote called Gotta Get Back to Memphis that might be in there. I'm hoping they put it in there. They should, because it really reflects on the script and everything, you know.
Do you know when the movie's coming out?
October.
Okay. And is there anything else that you're doing today that you want the audience to know about?
I just want to know that I'm still doing it. I'm like B.B. King. I'm going to be there to the end. They'll have to run me off stage. You saw me on stage. You know how I am.
Yeah, you still do a great show.
Yeah.
So people should definitely look out for your touring and your music.
Yeah, I hope next time I come to Chicago that a lot of my new fans and my old fans and the fans that don't even know me will be there.
And you just did Loveitis on my friend's TV show. It should be on YouTube soon, I think.
Yeah, we just did a show too. What was the name of that show?
It's called Chicago-Go.
Chicago-Go, yeah. Right.
Okay, so do you have any last words for the audience?
Yeah, well, I just want to ask them, beg them to keep on loving soul music and keep on wanting real music.
That's definitely good advice.
Yeah, because there's guys like you to keep it alive, and we all need to keep it alive. Even though hip-hop is great and all that, but, you know, there's room always for the real soul music. That's when they say soul music, that's what it means. It's the soul of the music.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for being on the phone and doing the interview.
Okay, Bob, and yeah, it's been a pleasure. Next time I'm in Chicago, you better be there.
Okay. This last record I'm going to play is your big hit, which all the groups covered. This is Loveitis.